All right, let's do this. How are you, what the fuckers, what the fuck buddies, what the fuck nicks? What's happening? How's everything? Where are we at? How are you doing? Are you okay? Hey, before I get too lost in my rambling about this or that, I want to take a moment to congratulate us. All of us, I guess, but Brendan and myself, we have been doing this show 14 years. 14 years. This is the, I guess it was the birthday week, probably last week, but this is it. This is The Zone. WTF has been a podcast for 14 years. And I want to thank you, our listeners. I want to thank all our guests. I mean, look, it's not an award show or anything, but it's another year doing this, and 14 is a pretty long run for a podcast, and we have stayed pretty level. We do all right. We're turning out good material. I'm always excited to do the show, but I want to thank Brendan McDonald, who's listening to this right now, for we were there at day one. It was just the two of us. Making this thing happen. Obviously, there's been assistants and bookers and contributors to the show, musicians, but the basic formula was Mark records the thing, and then Mark sends the thing to Brendan, who produces the thing, and then Brendan puts the thing up. That's the magic sauce right there. Yep. Happy birthday, WTF. 14 years. Wild, man. I don't know if it's flying by, but all of a sudden it's here. Today, I talked to Michael Simon. He's a chef, a restaurant owner. You know him from the Food Network shows like Iron Chef America. He was also on The Chew. He had some great restaurants around the country, first in Cleveland and then in other cities. I've gone to his restaurants in Cleveland. I knew his sous chef. Jonathan Sawyer had a restaurant down the street from Lola. He had the Greenhouse Tavern. I've known about Michael for a long time. I have not interviewed a chef in a while. Chefs, I like chefs. I think that there was a part of me that always wanted to be a chef. I remember when I fucked up in high school and I was thinking about, living the rest of my life off the land or wandering around my hometown. But there was a period where I thought I would go to culinary school, but then it just looked like a massive ordeal. And I always was interested in cooking. I was a short order cook in high school, and I worked in restaurants. I tried to be a line chef when I was living in Boston after college and drinking a lot. I was a bad waiter, and there was an opening on the line. I talked the manager into letting me try it, and what a disaster. I just thought, look, man, if I put the apron on and get to hang out with those guys on the line, the fryer guy, the grill guy, the salad guy, it was me and three other guys back there. But you got to sync up, man. You got to know what the fuck you're doing. You can't just throw a bunch of onion rings into the breading and then throw them into the fryer so it turns out like a big clump. It was so embarrassing and so brutally humiliating. I think I lasted on the line 2 days. I fucked up everything, but it did give me an understanding of how the restaurant business works. And, but I always like to cook and I know how to cook. I can look at a recipe and figure it out. I talked to Michael a little bit about that, but it's a weird thing as I'm going on in my life. Did I mention that Todd Barry is also here? Todd Barry dropped by and, he's got a new special out. So I talked to him for a bit. And before I ramble on about cooking, maybe I can do that after. I'm at Largo in Los Angeles this Wednesday, September 6th. Then I'll be doing 5 shows at Helium in St. Louis, September 14th through 16th. I'll be at the Las Vegas Wise Guys in the Arts District on September 22nd and 23rd for 4 shows. And then Bellingham, Washington, I'll be at the Mount Baker Theater for 1 show on Saturday, October 14th, as part of the Bellingham Exit Festival. You can go to WTFpod.com/tour for tickets. There will be more dates forthcoming. So that is happening, okay? That is happening. There's another thing I wanted to talk about, and I think it's reasonable. I got an email from a concerned, I would imagine, a psychotherapist, but somebody who puts something into perspective. When I talk to Maria or I talk about mental health in general, I think most of you, that I'm not speaking of a professional, but I think the one thing that this person had issue with is that when I say things like, you know, I was a little borderline-y, or he or she's a little bipolar, that this person wanted to make it sort of explicit in telling me that, look, a personality disorder is a personality disorder. It's something intrinsic to your being. You know, it's not, and we all do this. We all throw around diagnoses. You know, I think he's narcissistic. I think he's bipolar. I think he's borderline, whatever. But there is a context and a way of diagnostics that determine whether someone is truly ill or mentally compromised with one of these personality profiles. And this person was basically making the point that you can't throw around the symptoms sort of disjointed and haphazardly, because it may imply to people that are really mentally compromised or suffer from these personality disorders, it might give them false hope or think that there's something to not take seriously in their own diagnosis. So I just want to make clear that I'll be more aware of that. And obviously, we all know that all of us have at least one or two symptoms of every psychological disorder. But that does not mean that you have the personality disorder. And, you know, I didn't think I needed to explain this, but maybe in lieu of this email and also speaking to people who are in my audience that have, you know, serious personality disorders, I don't want to give false hope or diminish the seriousness of their condition. And by, you know, me throwing them around like that, it may diminish that. Or also when I say things like, I think I was a little borderline-y when I was younger, implies to people that are seriously suffering from that disorder the idea that maybe it goes away, you know, maybe it's not as serious. So look, not a mental health professional. We'll continue talking about mental health. We'll be a little more careful when I throw around diagnostics or labels. But thank you for that email, Chris. So Todd Berry's here. I'll talk about cooking a bit before Michael, but Todd came by. He was in town. I hadn't seen him in a while. I've known Todd Berry a very long time. We go back to the early days of both of us, back when we neither one of us could really get work at any of the New York clubs, and we'd wander around the East Village wondering why. But I always liked seeing Todd. And when he asked if he could come on to promote his new special, Todd Berry Domestic Short Hair, I said, sure. It's available to watch on YouTube. Just search it or go to the All Things Comedy YouTube channel to watch Todd. And this is my just a little like old school WTF shorty with Todd Berry.
I just had a culinary experience that was unlike any other. I did a corporate gig, you know, because I'm kind of a picky eater.
Yeah.
But I went to a place called, I think it was called Ever in Chicago.
Yeah.
And Rory.
Scoville.
Yeah. Like, we were both doing this guy's 40th birthday party.
Yeah.
But he knew this guy who ran this place Ever. And it's like a place where it's like $235 per person.
Yeah.
But the guy hooked us up.
Yeah.
And it's just like we come out, like six waiters come out and all simultaneously refill your water glass.
Oh, really?
And I ate like rabbit. I'd never eaten rabbit.
No?
No, I made a pact to myself. Like, I'm going to eat whatever's in front of me, which
really?
Is really
a big deal for you.
It's a huge deal. Also, you don't want to be at that kind of thing and be like, nah, waving something off.
Yeah.
No.
And then asking for something that's not on the menu.
Yeah, you have a chicken Caesar.
Yeah. Yeah. And how was the rabbit?
The rabbit was actually my favorite thing, but I think it was also like, it was just like, you know, they give you a little small portion.
Sure.
And as well seasoned and spicy or whatever.
It was like chicken, right?
Yeah, it was good.
Yeah.
But, I don't think I'm going to be like,
seeking it out?
Yeah, don't give me like, do you have rabbit?
Yeah, I'm only eating rabbit.
I had rabbit in Chicago. I'm big into rabbit.
Yeah, well, they used it sometimes in sauces. I don't know. I think I've eaten rabbit, but I don't remember it. I'm having a hard time with, I didn't get into the vegan thing for ethical reasons, but like I've gotten hypersensitive to animals lately.
Yeah?
Yeah, I mean, sometimes I'll flip through Instagram and you just see those interspecies affection videos.
Oh my God, yeah.
They kill me, man. I can't. And I feel like we've done such a disservice. Like, I just feel terrible for animals every day.
Yeah, and I don't know if you see these, like, Instagram posts where, like, this is Charlie's last day. Like, where oh, they film, no. like, they're going to put him down the next thing. Like, God, you're trying to wreck me here?
Yeah.
I'm in a coffee shop.
Crying.
Crying over some strange guy's cat.
Do you remember, like, I remember, like, you did always have sort of a specific food thing. I went to New York. I was there a couple of weeks ago for a few days, just hiding and just for no reason, and just trying to go to museums and feel the city and recharge. You know, I hadn't done comedy in a club in New York in years.
Yeah.
I just won't do it. I just can't. I don't know why. I went to the Stand. It was okay, you know, but like, there's something about me and doing stand up in New York. It's almost like going to where the trauma happened.
Yeah. Scene of the crime.
Exactly. You know, like, I still get that weird kind of like, oh, fuck, I got to lock it. Like, there's nothing, you know, comfortable about it. All the weird willies come back.
Yeah. I'm trying, like, lately to just be comfortable not having having jokes not work.
I'm working on that, too.
Which is the hardest thing.
How are you doing with that?
Oh, I sort of am I have a special that came out yesterday.
That's what we're talking about. Oh, what was that, on YouTube?
Yeah, on YouTube.
What's it called?
It's called Domestic Short Hair.
Is it all about your cat?
There's a lot about my cat on there. But
I do cat jokes, yeah.
Well, hey, wait. I did them first. No.
Oh, yeah. I'm sure there's no crossover. I usually do one or two.
That'd be funny if there's a guy who claimed that, hey, I'm the guy who came up with cat jokes.
I'm the cat guy.
Notice they were kind of goofy.
So you're trying to, you self-publish this thing? How does that work?
It's All Things Comedy, Bill Burr's and Al Madrigal's company.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah, they paid for it, and they tried to sell it and didn't sell.
Where did you shoot it?
In Chicago.
Where?
At the Den Theater.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Which is nice.
Yeah.
About 300, 250 feet.
Yeah.
And so it's perfect size. They treat you really nicely there, and it's a good layout.
Yeah.
But so I did it there, but it's like over a year ago, so.
Right.
So there's a couple like little COVID jokes that perhaps I could have cut out, but I didn't.
It's so weird to me that like, you know, like there are still people talking about like, you know, Beretta. Or yeah, it's just like, that's a bad reference, but it's sort of like, we all went through this traumatic, awful fucking thing for 3 years. The world has not really recovered from the trauma of it. And people are like, yeah, go, it's out. You don't mention it.
Yeah, I mean,
what the fuck?
I shouldn't even be talking about this out loud because I did glance at my YouTube comments, which is, I know, better than to do that.
That's going
to
be your life for a fucking...
The vast majority of them were very nice.
Yeah?
But then there's a couple, and I also think if you talk about COVID in any way that's like, maybe it was okay to wear a mask.
Yeah.
People are reacting to that. They're not reacting comedically. They're
just the worst. They're just like, the fucking worst.
You know, the type of people who say face diaper or something.
Yeah,
like
yeah,
that.
Yeah. No, it's the worst. Like I put up some post on, I did an Instagram live and my TikTok guy put up this post about Barbie on TikTok, and it got like almost like 2.7 million views.
Yeah.
And that was just me saying I liked the movie.
Right.
And that if you're a guy that got offended by this movie, you're a fucking baby.
Right.
And it was just like a shitstorm of opinion about all these guys. It's all dug in their head, all this right-wingy, woke thing. It's just like so tedious and dumb. And it's sort of like, and then the picture that there's a guy that sits there and makes a decision to post that.
Right.
It's like, who the fuck is that? I got to let it go. I can't look at any of the comments.
Yeah, I promised myself I wouldn't look anymore.
Do you do it on Twitter too?
On Twitter, I sometimes, I don't get a lot of hate on, I've gotten hate on Twitter, but what am I talking about? But I just feel like even I went on Reddit and the comments were good on the special.
Oh yeah?
And I'm like, I'm
not even sure I know how to go on Reddit.
Yeah, I mean, I just discovered it through through Googling.
Yeah.
But.
What do you got? You just do a search? You go to Reddit and do.
Well, what I did was put my own name in and then the name of the special in,
right.
And they came up with that.
So now I'm afraid to do a YouTube thing. Like,
are you?
I need a patron.
Yeah, like I mean.
I mean, I didn't, obviously I'm in a position where I got one with the HBO special, but my fear of the YouTube thing is that like I put all that work into it and then you just got to be like, look at how many views it gets. And
right,
it's going to kill me.
Right, yeah, it's true. With Netflix, at least they
don't tell
were
you.
Nice enough to not tell you one thing about how well your special was done.
Yeah, right,
and you just like, hey, can I find out my special? Nope.
Yeah,
aren't we working together?
Yeah, I know. They won't
should
tell
this be friendly?
Yeah, I notice it's hard to find, and it's only been up for 3 days.
But
is there a problem?
I mean, I did a reframe with how I feel about the special because I have no choice, but because it didn't, no one bought it.
Right.
So I was like, all right, this is going to be a, I'm kind of tired of all the jokes on this anyway.
Right. Oh, that's good.
So it'll be a calling card and hopefully help me sell tickets on the road.
Are you touring now or no?
Yeah, I'm on a tour that I, it's kind of a, it's kind of embarrassing, but it's called the Half Joking Tour, where it's half jokes and then it half crowd work.
Oh, okay.
I thought that was an easy way to tour without having a new hour.
Yeah. And is it going well?
I've only done three shows and they've gone pretty well.
Where?
I did Ashland, Virginia is where I started, which is near Richmond, which was great. Then I did Annapolis.
Annapolis?
Yeah. And then I did Philadelphia.
Philly?
Yeah.
Where in Philly?
City Winery.
Oh, people are doing those.
I know.
Like, I talked to Mandy last night or the other night, and he's doing them.
Yeah, he's doing the Philly one, I know. So.
Yeah, he's, like, doing a lot of them. I didn't realize it was a chain.
Yeah, it is. It's gotten, it's, they're popping up everywhere. Yeah.
What, do they usually see, what, 400 or 500 or something?
This one was, this was pretty big, probably 350 or something.
Yeah. And they, because they do a lot of music, right?
Yeah, they're mainly music, mainly, like, singer-songwriter people and, like, you know. Like
nice venue, though?
Yeah, and they treat you nice.
Grown-up people?
Food's good, yeah.
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 What about that one in New York City? There's a good one there, right?
Yeah, they have two rooms. They have a smaller room, which I think is actually better for comedy, but it is smaller. It's called The Loft at City Winery.
It's good?
About 175, yeah.
So what's the big plan for life? You're just going to keep... Do you ever have that moment where you're like, how am I still living this life?
It is weird, yeah. It's like I...
Because we're old.
Right. It's a little scary, but...
Yeah. There's a big chunk of time that... I don't think it was COVID. Maybe COVID didn't help anything, but in terms of like time gets very fluid. And now all of a sudden, you know, I'm going to be 60, you're going to be 60. And it's like... It didn't... It's. But I don't think it went by fast.
No, it's...
But it does feel like, you know, how'd I get here?
Yeah, it's just like, you know, it's just, you just think, oh, you start thinking about every decision's much more important and like...
Yeah, but also the enjoying yourself thing comes up a lot for me. Like, am I doing that?
Oh, as opposed to working too hard or...
Or just like not knowing how to enjoy myself or no, like you're going to Madrid, that sounds like a nice thing.
Yeah.
You're able to enjoy yourself?
Yeah, I am. I mean, it's a little stressful because sometimes they're like, oh, I want to write some jokes and I'm going away. But then, I don't want to be the person who doesn't go away.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, and also we come from this weird work ethic. Like, I'm doing more comedy now than I think I've ever done in my fucking life.
Really?
Yeah. I go out, like, three nights a week, work out shit. I do hours at Dynasty Typewriter trying to work it out. And during the pandemic, I was like, man, maybe I don't have to do it anymore. You know, maybe I'm all better. I'm like, but then as soon as other people started doing, I'm like, fuck, I gotta get out there again.
Yeah, I mean, there's a reason we've been doing this for pushing 38 years or 36 years or whatever.
What is it?
I don't know. I mean, I do.
You know, help me out.
I do worry that sometimes, like, am I just locked into this now?
Right.
Because it's a big difference between your first time on stage and your 10,000th time on stage.
Well, we obviously are locked into it, and obviously we get something out of it, and it is what we do.
Yeah.
But then, like, it becomes this thing, like, well, we're just fortunate that we have an audience at the age we are.
Mm-hmm.
Because there's, like, three generations after us already that are all kind of, you know, going at it.
Yeah.
So my moments, like, you start to look out at your audience, and I'm like, oh, I'm middle-aged people out there.
Yeah.
And, you know, why wouldn't there be? That's who I am. What am I expecting?
Yeah, I've been getting a lot of families at my shows lately, where you're just like, okay. And it's always like, all right, we got the father, what's on the mom. I mean, one guy brought his mom in Virginia, brought his mom and his sister, and she's like, I'd never heard of you.
Yeah, that's always good.
But she was having a good time. She wasn't saying it in a shitty way, but she's like, yeah, I know you. I'm figuring your 28-year-old son's probably the one who would—
Brought you in.
Yeah.
Yeah. I don't think I get a lot of families, but I get young people that are kind of like me.
Yeah.
That were sort of, I think that, I mean, I get smart people. I have good audiences. And that, but the point is like, I don't know what I'd be doing if I didn't have people coming to see me. Would we still be fucking?
That's true. I mean, I do like to sort of go, oh, this is kind of a cool little life I've cut out for myself.
Well, that's good. You got to have that gratitude. But, it's like, it's not like we're not like Seinfeld, who's like, you know, he's going to decide to go out and make $1 billion because he's like internationally loved.
Right.
I mean, like there's some points where I'm sort of like, do I even need to do this anymore? And I think about that all the time, but like I clearly need to do it for myself.
But like, what are you going to, I don't,
that, I don't know what
retirement
I'm
going to do. Doesn't sound fun.
Doesn't it? I don't know if I could do it, but there's nothing dragging me back in. Like if I stopped doing comedy and I didn't make a big deal about it, I'd just be like, you know, I don't, what happened to that guy? You know what I mean?
Right.
But of course I talk about it on the podcast, but I think about like a point where maybe I stop. I don't know really what that looks like or what I do, but one of the benefits of being comics is clearly we have an ability to do almost nothing for days on end.
Yeah.
So if you just take you just take the going out and doing a set part out of that, you know, what do you have?
Yeah. Here's a heavy question. Do you ever worry about losing it?
Losing my funny?
Yeah. Your fastball.
I see it happening to people.
Oh, I've seen it. Or you're just like, oh my God.
It's usually when people don't do it for a while and they come back.
Yeah.
And, you know, I was talking about that with Patton the other night. Like like we were talking about Kumail, is that there are guys, Patton goes out a lot, but there is this sort of, there's a new generation of comedy goers. And I know that a lot of times when I do the store, maybe a third of the people know who I am. You know, the only people that everyone knows who they are at a very high level of saturation. Do you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
But I talked to somebody, you know, I said, do you know John Mulaney? And they're like, no. So it's, everything's this sort of weird bubble. But so if you're not going out and doing those shows where you have to do the job for people that don't know you, how are you going to stay in shape? How are you going to get up and do just regular comedies if people don't know you, if you don't fucking stay in shape? You got to stay in shape, right?
Right, right.
So I don't know if I worry about losing it.
Okay.
The ability to sort of do what I do. Now I will. Oh, now I'll think about it.
Because I put it in your head.
Yeah, do you
think about it? Mission accomplished.
You think about it?
I think about it because there's even like songwriters, and I'm not going to name names, but people are like, oh, that's not what it used to be.
Yeah, they think they're doing great. Yeah.
I mean, I remember had an English professor was talking about, I think, Faulkner.
And yeah.
He said at some point the spirit left him.
Yeah.
I was like, And then I did look up the professor, and he was arrested for stalking. That's just a side note.
Guess the spirit didn't leave him.
Yeah. Did you ever do that? Look up someone, you're just like, oh, what happened to that guy? It was a little weird. Oh, yeah. Arrested for stalking. Yeah, that's the guy.
Yeah, he had the bad spirit in him.
But, yeah, so, I mean, I do worry about losing it, but a lot of it's just like, what can you do? There's certain things we can't do anything about. That was deep, but.
Yeah, I mean, like, I think that the thing that drives me stays pretty vital, you know what I mean? Like, I've never been like a joke-to-joke guy, but like, I seek to engage, and like, I think you lose it when some part of you just kind of walks through it. Like, I think if you're not engaged, and you're unable to get there, then it's a problem.
Right, if you're phoning it in.
Yeah, but I don't even know how to do that. I don't even know what that looks like. It seems like everything I do requires all of me to do it.
Right.
Like, I don't know.
Well, what if the crowd's just kind of,
Well, what I used to do is, you know, just get mad, make it weird.
Yeah.
But, you know, I do what you do. Like, if it's not great, you sort of go like, ah, I thought that would get better.
Right.
You kind of make light of it.
Yeah.
But other times I realize, and this was the big grown-up realization about, you know, God forbid I had this when I was 20, you know, 5 or 30. It's just that, like, some nights aren't good.
Right.
And, you know, you get what you can. Like, you can do your best joke, and then you feel the level of that.
Mm-hmm.
And you know it's a good joke, and then you just have to decide, like, well, that's the peak of what these people are capable of.
Right. And also, but then there's also those audiences where, like, are too good.
Yeah.
Which is, you know.
It's always good to reprimand them for
that. Weird thing to have, weird problem to complain about. But there's the thing where, like, yeah, I can't assume that I'm going to get that every time.
Yeah, no, I had that happen, you know, fairly recently where, like, but I think that certainly people that would come see us are really kind of like, you know, these are dark times. So they do want relief.
Yeah.
And sometimes they come just sort of like, I hope they do it. You know, I hope they give us the,
right,
and they're excited to go.
Yeah, it's always interesting. Like, I'm sure you've gotten people who are just like, hey, you got me through a hard time.
Yeah.
Like, really? How did I do that? With my...
I get a lot of that.
My joke about going Old Navy. That...
Sometimes it's all it takes. To
yeah.
Like, I was talking to Bargatze the other night, and he told me something I said to him that, you know, he sort of remembers and thinks about, you know, in terms about doing comedy. I'm like, oh, well, I'm glad I helped out.
Yeah.
He's doing very well.
Yeah, he is.
He's a very funny dude.
Yeah, he's very funny. But I think that because I can't relate to, like, I was feeling blue. If I'm sad about something, I'm all in, man. I'm gonna turn on a comedy film to cheer me up. Like, yeah. It ain't gonna work.
Yeah,
no song will make it better. Nothing.
It just has to end on its own. But I did so many Instagram lives and all this stuff that it became a regular thing. I think that it's really that sort of standard thing of like whatever makes people feel less alone.
Yeah,
even for a moment, it's like a goddamn life preserver.
Yeah, I'm like moved when someone tells me that. You know.
Oh yeah, yeah. It's great. I'm sort of like I'm always sort of as gracious as I can be and just tell them glad to help out. And a lot of it has to do with booze and things like that, mental problems. Like, you know, I put up an interview with Maria Bamford.
Uh-huh.
And those kind of interviews, it's like, you know, there's just people that are alone in their heads and it's not good. And if they hear anybody saying anything that they can relate to, they're like, oh my God, thank God.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, it's like that easy. I think jokes are really like that sometimes. If they can relate to it and you make them look at something a different way, even if it's simple,
yeah,
it's like relieving.
Yeah.
Like, we're doing God's work, Todd.
I was about to say the exact same thing.
All right. So what's the name of the special?
It's called Domestic Short Hair.
Okay.
It's on YouTube, on the All Things Comedy YouTube channel.
When you go on, you leaving for Madrid from here? When are you going back to New York?
I'm going back on Thursday. Then we go to Madrid.
All right. Well, good seeing you, man.
Good seeing you. Thanks for having me again.
Yeah. There you go. That was Todd. Me and Todd catching up. Again, that Todd Barry Domestic Short Hair special is available on the All Things Comedy YouTube channel. And now cooking. This is a doubleheader. We got Michael Simon coming up. And as I was saying at the beginning of the show, I always was drawn towards cooking, and it's interesting because my mother could not. My mother is a lifetime eating disorder person, but manageable. She, as I've said many times, part of her focus in life and her job was maintaining a fairly real eating disorder and maintaining a particular weight for a very long time and eating very limited things, some of them not appealing. But when it came to cooking, that was not really happening. There was a lot of TV dinners. There was a lot of defrosting things. There were a lot of attempts. She would buy frozen foods at high-end places that sold frozen foods. There was a place called Tully's in Albuquerque, sold Italian stuff. And then she'd sort of defrost that and mash it together with some of her own ideas. And TV dinners. And it would not great, you know, while she sat there and ate a mountain of salad. But nonetheless, because of that, or in light of that, I became sort of kind of fascinated with cooking. But as I was saying before, I didn't really realize that you could just cook, that you could just be a good cook until college when I had a professor who was obsessed with me, predatory, took advantage of my vulnerable, nebulous sense of self and identity, and really tried to get me in bed and tried to convince me that I was gay. And it was completely boundaryless and in retrospect, not on the level and not appropriate. But oddly, though I didn't turn out to be gay, I was very impressed with this guy. And there were, you know, dinner parties at his house. And one of the things that he changed my life in a lot of ways, is that he was this self-taught gourmet chef of a kind, and he was just able to, you know, manage these dinner parties and cook these amazing things without really thinking twice about it. And if I took anything from him, it was this idea that I could do that. And I think about it all the time, that you can, if you put together a kitchen and you have the stuff you need to cook, and you are focused and have an understanding of putting things together, whether they're recipes or improvising or whatever you want, that you can do it. You don't need training, and obviously everyone knows this. I mean, Michael Simon was on the Food Network. I mean, that showed everybody how to cook, but either you can or you can't. But maintaining a kitchen and cooking for yourself it's good for you, and it's a tremendous gift as a hobby. It's very satisfying to cook. Sometimes I'll spend hours cooking and minutes eating everything I cooked. So the balance is not great, but it's nice to be able to cook, and I will thank Gary Orgel for giving me that gift and also fucking me up in the head pretty good for a lot of years. But somehow or another, the gift of cooking and finding the confidence to do that overrides the trauma of his predatory nature at the time. Rest in peace, Gary. So Michael Simon came over here, and he's got a new book, a new cookbook, Simply Simon Suppers. He's a great chef. With a good story, nice guy. The new book, Simply Simon Suppers, recipes and menus for every week of the year, comes out next week, Tuesday, September 12th. You can pre-order it right now. And this is me having a conversation with the lovely Michael Simon. Some people are surprised that I cook, and I realize, and just tell me if you think this is true, some people can't cook.
Agreed.
And I think the reason is that if you look at a recipe and you can't picture how it's supposed to come out, you can't cook it. Like how all the pieces come together. Like if you're just a person that's like, oh, I'm going to throw this in, I'm going to throw this in, I'm going to throw this in, with very little basic technique, if you can't visualize how it comes together, you're going to be like, what happened?
I think the visualization helps. I also think, sadly,
yeah.
I mean, in my opinion, I guess, that there are people out there that food's just not that, they eat food purely for fuel.
Right.
And those people tend to not be able to cook because... Not because they can't, but more they just don't care.
Yeah, that's sad to me because, like, sometimes in my kitchen, it's like I'm running a restaurant. Yeah, right. Like, because I'll cook for the week, but I've been vegan lately. But that makes it more challenging and interesting.
No, 100%. My wife was vegetarian for 23 years.
And she stopped?
Vegan for three. She started eating meat again during the pandemic.
Why?
But not a lot. She still eats very, very, very little, if any, red meat.
It wasn't even an ethical thing for me. I just want to see if I get my numbers down.
Yeah, she did it. She just has never felt great when she ate red meat.
Uh-huh.
So she never ate a lot of red meat anyhow.
Yeah.
And then she went just to seafood, and then she stopped seafood. And, you know, now she eats a little bit of seafood again, an occasional chicken kind of thing.
Yeah, I'm not being terribly hard on myself, but I do like the control element of it. Like because I got hold of, do you remember Angelica Kitchen?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
I got hold of her cookbook, which is sort of a basic macro balance, you know, in terms of putting stuff together.
Right.
And I'm kind of into it, man.
Angelica Kitchen was a great restaurant.
Yeah, making my own sauerkraut.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Fermenting. No, it's fun. Fermenting's fun. I love to ferment.
Yeah, I'm not going nuts.
Go nuts.
Really?
Mark, go nuts.
Really? Get all the little jars?
Yeah, do it. It's fun. I mean, and then you get all there's tons of health benefits, man. You get, you know,
I hear gut health
and the probiotics.
Do we know that for sure?
Here's what I'm going to say. I don't know if you know anything for sure. I tend to, like, my grandfather lived to 103 years old.
Oh, so you're good. That's it's all about.
That side. Like, that. I'm good on one side, bad on the other. But he ate, for breakfast every day, he ate eggs and rye toast with goose fat, like every day. He also made his own sauerkraut.
Oh, yeah?
He didn't eat any packaged foods. He always cooked his own meals.
Sugar?
Very little sugar.
That's the thing there, I think.
You know, and he was healthy.
Yeah.
He died during the pandemic, actually.
At 103?
At 103. But he lived on his own till he was 102.
Good brain.
Yeah, and was mentally fine. Like, his body just eventually gave out. Like, his bones just gave out. But
yeah, I don't know about all that the gut health. Because, I mean, I'm drinking a gallon of coffee a day.
Same.
And, you know, I don't know what the gut I think it's a lot of it's a racket.
A lot of it's a racket, but I think also there is, you know, I did two cookbooks called Fix It With Food.
Yeah, well, so you had a big shift, right?
Yeah, I mean, I have, about 25 years ago, I found out I had discoid lupus and RA.
That can be bad.
Yeah, lupus. And so, but I mean, I have the external lupus, not the as bad one, but like basically, if I don't, if my diet gets wonky, if I'm out in the sun too long, you know, I start feeling the effects.
Yeah.
So and in my early 30s and late 20s, I just, like, whatever. I just kind of plowed through it. And then as I got older, you know, I was like, ooh, this is starting to affect me more.
Huh.
And I didn't want to go on meds.
Yeah.
You know, I'm already on, you know, I genetically have a little bit high cholesterol.
That's what I got.
Yeah. So I take a cholesterol pill. And I just didn't want to take any medication. So I started tweaking my diet.
Yeah.
And finding out what my triggers were. And it turned out for me, it ended up being dairy and sugar.
Like, yeah.
When I eat those two things, my joints and everything hurt.
Really?
Yeah. So, like, I do think that, you know, gut health, this, that, the other thing. Who the hell knows?
But sugar, you know? We know.
Sugar, we know.
Yeah.
And then ultimately, it's like, one thing I do know is, and everybody, I think, knows, they just choose not to, food, what you put in your body is what you get out of your body.
Yeah.
You eat like shit, you feel like shit.
Yeah.
You eat good, you feel good.
Well, that's the thing. That was what I wanted to see with the cholesterol. I guess we'll just talk like old men for a minute. But this is what we do. I got a friend who I see now, like a friend I've known forever. He's like, 10 minutes on health and that's it. Then we're moving to another subject. I'm starting the clock. Let's go. So I got a, but so like I get this colonoscopy, so I know I'm clean, right?
Right. Yep.
So I'm like, I'm going to do vegan. You know, I'm on 10 milligrams of statin. That's what I was on.
Okay.
And my LDL usually lingers around 125, 130. So it's not horrible, right? So I'm like, I just want to see. So I'm on the statin and I do a week on vegan and I got a blood test. It went down to 80. That's on the statin.
That's interesting.
And then like I said, well, fuck it. I'll get off the statin. I'll go 3 months vegan. And that guy, it just went up to 100. And because of my HDL, the balance, the ratio, it got me off of meds. So I was like, well, fuck it. I can eat like this.
Yeah. See, now I because my wife was a vegan, I ate healthy.
Yeah.
At least a couple days a week.
Right.
Because, I mean, I'm a carnivore. I mean, I eat a lot of.
Your whole, you're meat focused.
I like meat. I'm a meat guy. Yeah. I'm meat centric, you know. I mean, I grew up in Cleveland. I mean, we didn't know what a green vegetable was. Yeah. Like, it was like, you know, like I'm Greek and Sicilian, so we ate a lot of like bitter greens and stuff. But like,
greens.
I was like the weird kid on the street. You know, what the hell is that? That's a vegetable, guys. You should try it, you know.
So the dandelion greens you ate?
Oh, yeah. Dandelion, escarole, all those kind
just
of greens.
Boiled?
Sauteed. My mom was my mom is a real good girl.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
You know, when I went. When my cholesterol got weird, I'm like, oh, maybe it's because I eat too much meat.
Yeah.
You know, they say you eat too much meat. Right. So I went vegan for 2 months.
Mm.
My numbers didn't change at all.
Interesting.
Nothing changed.
So you're locked in. See, I don't know. See, I'm going to go back.
But my mom, you know, my mother is, I have a hilarious family. My dad is 6'4" and about 195 pounds.
Yeah.
And my mom is 4'10" and like just, since she's turned 80, is now over 100 pounds. They exercise, they're healthy, and my dad was
these
a big
the
runner. Yeah, the Greeks and Italians. Mm. And, you know, my dad, like ran 8 miles a day. They're healthy people.
Yeah.
But my mom has high cholesterol. Like, if you look at her, you'd be like, and she eats healthy.
Yeah.
I mean, healthy, healthy.
Well, that's the other thing about these, you know, these paleo people. And there are people literally eating only meat.
That's not good.
Well, right. But there might be benefits to it.
Maybe.
But
I don't know.
But you got to take into consideration that some people have fucking heart disease.
Yep.
And you're telling them to, you know, and well, you could sit around and go on the internet all day long. But, you know, docs say, look, you got a little heart disease. Don't eat so much of this.
Yeah. And I'm of the Julia Child's thought process.
Yeah.
Everything in moderation, including moderation.
Yeah.
You know, it's like, look, I know dairy fucks me up.
I don't eat any of it.
You know, but occasionally I'm with my granddaughter and she wants ice cream and I love ice cream.
Gotta eat ice cream.
So I have ice cream.
Sure.
And I know that the next day, now I know what my triggers are. So like, I know the next day I'm going to be a little achy, whatever.
Really?
Like, it's kind of like, you know.
I feel hungover.
It's kind of, well, I was going to say, like, I know that if I have two old fashions the next day, I'm good. If I have three old fashions, the next day I'm not good, you know?
Yeah.
But sometimes I still have three old fashions.
Well, you got to live a little.
Yeah.
You just have to take the hit.
Yeah.
So the other question I wanted to start out with is, I remember seeing, like, there's this thing, I've interviewed some of your peers, but we talk about this egg thing, you know, like, I remember seeing a Top Chef once where, you know, the final challenge was the perfect egg business. Now, what is it about this perfect egg business?
It's a true business, man. It's like, so, look, an egg, to cook an egg properly takes a lot of finesse. And so, like, when young cooks would come to our restaurant, yeah, like Lola, our fine dining restaurant,
yeah,
the first day they got there, I would be like, make me a French omelet, make me a soft scramble, make me a sunny side up.
That was the test.
That was the test. And it wasn't, like, and everybody likes their eggs different. It's not about how you like your eggs. This isn't about how you like your eggs. Like, I like those eggs just how they are. Like, I like an omelet that's has no color and is a little bit creamy in the center.
Yeah.
I like very soft custardy eggs.
Yeah.
Now, I do like a hard fried egg because that's how I grew up eating them with my grandfather, like crispy on the bottom
and
runny
too.
On the top. Like, we used to call them dippy eggs when we were kids.
I like a broken yolk.
I don't mind a broken yolk either. Yeah. Like, I just love eggs.
Yeah.
But the test was to see if you had the control of the heat of the pan.
Right.
And the finesse with your hands to do these three things perfect.
Right.
And if you did, there was a very good chance that I could then teach you how to be a great cook.
Okay.
If you really struggled with the, like, if someone showed me passion, but they struggled with the ability to control the heat of the pan and the hand skills and dexterity to do these things, I would still hire them.
Right.
But maybe they start in the pantry, or maybe they start in a place where we have to get them to develop these skills. Because if they, you can't teach passion, you could teach technique, you could teach skill, you could teach all those things. It's like, you know, I used to tell people that worked for me that sometimes did the hiring, some of my chefs, I'm like, an asshole is an asshole. You can't teach somebody to be a, like, they're coming to us already that way.
Yeah.
Like, so.
And that's not unusual in your profession.
No. So we want to hire good people.
Right.
And the rest we could show them.
Right.
But the egg test was just to see where they were with their ability.
But the asshole factor in the world of chefs, sometimes, you know, assholes do all right.
Yeah. I could name several.
Sure.
Eventually, I do eventually think it bites them all, though. I think if you are, look, when I'll be 54 in September. When I was coming up, it was a different world.
Yeah.
It was very aggressive. Most of the chefs were European. They yelled, they screamed, they prodded you with meat forks. They burnt you intentionally. Like, there was some, it was insane. It was like, what am I doing?
They,
like,
burnt you intentionally.
Oh, yeah. Like, I had a French chef that I worked for, and he would move, he'd walk over to my station and move the pans down just enough so my arm would hit the handle that just came out of the oven, and it would, like, stick to my flesh, you know? And I'd, like, look over, and he'd be like, well, you shouldn't have your sleeves rolled up.
Oh.
You know?
It's like conditional training.
Yeah. I'm like, oh, my God, this is insane.
You remember, though, didn't you?
I did. I mean, I still rolled my sleeves up because I was a prick.
Right.
But, you know, I, like, remember talking to my, you know, I come from a very blue-collar family. My grandfather was a pipe fitter. My dad worked at Ford. You know, and I was a pretty good wrestler growing up as a kid. And I said to my dad, I'm like, thank God you and Pap molded me and then all those years of wrestling. Because I don't know if I could deal with this otherwise. But then what the message that it sent to me is, like, I learned a ton from these chefs. And I would never say I wouldn't do it again. I would do it tomorrow. But I also realized that this isn't how I wanted to run my kitchens.
Well, let's talk about the temperament, because, like, I don't know much about Cleveland, but I always liked it when I worked there, and it just so happened that my experience of Cleveland over the years that I've done stand up there was always that block where you had restaurants.
Yeah.
So, you know, but I would go to Slimans.
Oh, it's awesome.
You know, like, you know, I'd go do radio, and they drive us over to Slimans for corned beef at 10 in the morning.
The best.
And it's packed out. You're getting corned beef and eggs.
Packed.
Yeah.
Packed.
And then I remember there was a grilled cheese restaurant.
Melt.
Yeah, that mm-hmm. was a thing.
Definitely.
But so growing up there, like you're 54, so do you remember it as a thriving city?
No.
Yeah.
No, I mean, you know, my grandfather grew up in a what ended up being a rough part of town outside of, I mean, technically it was Cleveland Heights, but it was off a street called Noble.
Yeah.
You know, and it was a blue collar town.
Right.
And downtown kind of died. Everybody moved out to the suburbs.
It already happened by the time you were a kid?
Yeah. I mean, like we would go to the Browns games and the Indians games back then, and the Cavs weren't even in downtown Cleveland. And my grandmother worked downtown at Higbee's. And the West Side Market was very near downtown, so I was downtown quite a bit. But it was it had by that time people had moved to the suburbs,
right?
And then when I moved home from New York in '90, shortly after that, like I was at a restaurant in the suburbs, and then my first chef job was in 1992 in a place in the city called Piccolo Mondo, and that kind of started the gentrification downtown.
Huh. So when you're growing up, what is the plan? So you're a wrestler. You got siblings?
I have a sister.
And you're a wrestler and you're just not a jockey guy, but what?
No, I mean, I was a little jockey, but I was kind of one of those jockey kids that got along with everybody.
Yeah.
And, you know, I went to a high school called St. Edward's, which was was and still is the number one wrestling school in
Catholic
the country.
High school?
Catholic high school.
You grew up Catholic?
I grew up Catholic. Mm. It's, you know, I'm a little scarred.
Yeah. Like real Catholic?
Like, I mean, like guilt. Like a lot of guilt. I had a lot of guilt in my life as a child.
But you believed there was a hell and everything else?
Yeah. You know. So I went to the school. It was the best wrestling school in the country. And you know, everybody that went to that school got a scholarship to college, which I needed to get because I came from a, you know, blue-collar, middle-class family.
Yeah.
And my junior year, I had a significant injury. I broke a plate and 14 screws in my arm and dislocated my elbow and blah, 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 blah.
That's from wrestling?
Wrestling.
And then my God.
Tried to come back from it my senior year. Now, I've been wrestling since I was 6. So I tried to come back my senior year and broke the plate in my arm.
Yeah.
So then back into surgery, year and 8 months in a cast. All my scholarships were gone. Started working in restaurants to help pay for college. Fell in love with the business, and here I am.
But what was that? Where did you know that you liked it? Because I always liked it, but I never, like, I worked in restaurants when I was high school. But they weren't high-end restaurants. It was just, you know, I did grill work.
Yeah, I mean, I did grill work to start and then worked at a nicer place after that. The minute I was in the restaurants, I love this.
The pace,
you know, I'm ADD. So it was like...
So when you saw 10, 12, 15 dupes on the line, you're like, we go.
Right, and then every, like, 8 minutes, you have a new thing. So it was like, you know, it's... I feel like a lot of chefs are probably ADD.
Yeah?
You know? Yeah, because it's... Our brain just... You're like... You know, you never have that squirrel moment because so much is going on and you always get like a new little toy, like essentially.
Sure.
You know, next dish, next dish, next dish, next dish.
Yeah.
So it's.
But you were doing grill stuff first?
Yeah. You know, my buddy's dad owned a barbecue joint.
Yeah.
I worked at the barbecue joint. But I fell in love with the business. I come home. I tell my mom and dad that, you know, at the time, there were only two culinary schools. There was a CIA and Hyde Park, New York, and there was Johnson and Wales in Rhode Island. And I tell my mom and dad, I think I want to go to culinary school to be a chef. Now, in 1985, there was no Food Network. There was no Celebrity Chef. There was no, you know, there were two fine dining restaurants in Cleveland that, you know, now they'd argue it. But my dad lost his mind. He's like, no, you're not like you're not going to school to be a laborer.
Right.
Like you're going to go to college because, you know.
But that's interesting because he saw it that way, because that's sort of true, because I would say that probably 80% of the people that come out of those schools become managerial chefs at restaurants, executive chefs at, you know, function places, right?
I mean, and back then, like, you know, you're getting an associate's degree. Like my dad looked at it like, you know, your grandfather was a pipe fitter. You're basically just, you're learning. You're a pipe fitter with a different skill or whatever. And that was great for my grandfather, and it's great for tons of people.
Yeah.
Like, but I just, he wanted me to go to college and get a traditional degree. And
sure.
You know, but so.
He just couldn't see past you being a cook.
No. I was going to school to be a cook. And then I, you know, he made me go to Cleveland State. I went to Cleveland State for a semester and got a 0.2, not a 2 point, a 0.2. And he said, how did you get a 0.2? I said, I don't know. I didn't go to a single class, but someone gave me a D, which I thought was very kind of them.
Yeah.
And then my mother, who was the one that everyone was afraid of in the house, said, this is bullshit. He's going to culinary school. It's what he wants to do. Like, she made it happen. I went to culinary school, and it obviously worked out good.
Because which one?
I went to the Culinary Institute of America in Hyde Park.
Yeah.
And then, you know, eventually my father worked for me, so it worked great.
What did he do for you?
He did the books.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah, yeah.
So now, like, because now I think it's something new has happened in the world of people's understanding of chefs, in that, you know, we like the Food Channel and the Food Network. I mean, I remember when Emeril came around, you know, it was just sort of like everybody was bam.
Oh, it was crazy. I mean, I started on Food Network in 1998. So I was there for the whole Emeril thing.
Yeah.
You know,
and he seemed like a good guy.
Great guy.
Yeah. But now with the popularity of the Bear, you know, people are like, oh, that's what's going on. And how true to it is it?
It's a little bit more frenetic. I mean, it's television. But sure. Like, I would say season two of The Bear, much more realistic than season one of The Bear.
Right.
Loved both seasons. But like, some of the things that you see in season two remind me of some of the things that would happen when I was coming up in the business. Like, you know, you start a job and you basically cut leeks for a month. Mm. And it's like, until you prove that you could cut the perfect leeks, you know, kind of like how Cousin polished silverware.
Yeah.
You know, like that's how those kind of restaurants always worked.
So when you go to culinary school, I mean, like the thing I notice about chefs and just in about like, you know, what I do in comedy is that, you know, it is a singular kind of expressive profession. It is hyper competitive. There are ways for you to stand out because of your particular craft, even though everybody learns basically the same way at a certain level, right?
100%.
And also there's a burnout rate, there's drugs, there's all of that stuff. But it is outside of skill, it's a culture of personalities, very strong ones.
Yeah, I think for television.
But I mean, but it just seems like if you're going to be in the game to win it, you know, the creativity and also the accessibility, it's very personal.
Yeah. Look, you go to school, you could work for great chefs, you could do all those things, but ultimately you're never going to have grand success if you're not creative, if you don't have your own thoughts. Like, a chef that just copycats other chefs is never going to be ultimately a super famous or successful chef, because you're just ripping off other people's shit. It'd be like a comedian, you know, like if you got up and just, who was your favorite comedian as a kid?
Oh, coming up?
Yeah.
Well, you know, like, you know, Richard Pryor.
Okay.
You know,
so like if you just went up and did Richard Pryor jokes for 2 hours,
be weird. Yeah.
People might laugh, sure. But you're never going to become famous doing Richard Pryor
jokes.
And
they'd wonder why I was talking from a black perspective.
Yeah. But it will also, like, musicians, you know, there's a cover band is never going to be famous. They can make a living.
Sure.
But, you know, they're never going to be Van Halen.
But there's also the same thing with music or with comedy, is that, you know, there are basics that you learn, and there is an evolution of style. But I, like, because I always heard, like, I got Julia Child's cookbook, and I was going to try to do stuff, but I don't like all that butter, you know. But it's still, when you go to chef school, right, it's still French cooking, right?
Yeah. But everything's based around French technique for the most part. So
why, like, is that?
Because they were technicians. Like, I mean, the Italians didn't need to be as technicians as much.
Because they just throw it in.
And they had beautiful product.
Uh-huh.
The French had shitty meats and, you know, their product wasn't as good. So they needed the Blancs, and they needed the Hollandaise and the Bernays. And they covered up the lack of product that they got in places like Italy and Greece with incredible sauce work technique.
Okay. So like, it was all to hide rancid meat?
Yeah, basically, you know. But like now, if you mix those great techniques that the French have with the products that you're able to get in America, that's when, in my opinion, you end up with something special. And then you throw creativity into it, and it takes it to another level.
So when you go to to school for this stuff, I mean, is it jarring? It's a whole new thing. All you know is you work in a couple of restaurants. Yeah. And, you know, you got to get your outfit and you got to get your knife.
Got to dress funny. They give you the checks, they give you the chef coat, they give you the knives. And then, you go through the classes in kind of an organized fashion, you know, where it starts with skills and then it moves into international. And then, you know, with every class that you take, it becomes a little bit more of a refined thought process. They try to show you as many different cuisines as you can. They can.
But are you thinking from the very beginning, like, I'm gonna push the envelope on this?
Yeah, 100%. That's how my brain works. Like, I can't help myself. Like,
but you learn the skills, and that you have to have a certain knack for that. There are some people, I imagine, that no matter what they do or how long they do it, they're not going to be able to just, like, do that dicing business.
Or they're just going to be tech. Like, maybe they're great at the dicing, but not the creativity. So they end up being great sous chefs and great technicians, or maybe a hotel chef or, you know, something of that nature. But my brain was always like, when I would even see a technique, I'd be like, okay, now how can I turn this into something else?
Yeah.
Like, so, but, you know, what's happened a little bit now with the younger cooks is they want to do the creative stuff before they know the techniques.
Yeah.
And you can't.
Yeah.
You know, it's like a painter. You can't say, like, oh, I'm an abstract artist. Well, you can't paint a line, dude.
Right. You got to know how to paint. Like, that's always the thing with poetry, with anything. Yeah. With the arts that have some wiggle room.
Right.
You know, people think, like, I can just start at the end.
Yeah, I'm just going to start at the end.
Yeah. But so did you guys, like, are there classmates of yours that became big chefs?
I'm a lot of successful chefs in my classmates. From a television standpoint, kind of, or...
But even a restaurant.
Critically acclaimed. A couple.
Yeah.
A couple. I mean, there's a kid named David Adjie. He's in Toronto, but he's owned some very successful restaurants in Toronto. There's been some successful chefs. I've been fortunate enough to have a lot of success, but, it's like anything else. You have to be good at what you do, obviously. That's the baseline. And then you need a little bit of luck, a little bit of timing, a little bit of those things. Like my
vision.
We opened Lola in 1997. I was 27 years old.
That's crazy.
Yeah, crazy. And then in 1998, Food and Wine named me one of the best new chefs in America. Food Network gave me a show, and Bon Appetit said we were one of the top 10, top 50 restaurants in the country and one of the top 10 new restaurants in the country. So all that happened in 98. I was like, holy shit, what's going on? You know,
27.
And my world changed.
But when you're, how long do you go to culinary school?
2 years.
So it's just 2 years.
Mm-hmm.
And then you're done. Now, where do you learn, like, the trajectory of, now I got to get some guys to bankroll my vision for a restaurant. I got to put together, like, where, how do you, like, when you're thinking about this stuff, what is going on in the culture that makes you decide what you're going to do at Lola? Do you know, you got to have some classic.
Yeah, well, there was 6 years in between graduation and that.
Well, what'd you do?
So I took a job. The big mistake a lot of young cooks make is they get out of school and they want to get a paycheck.
Right.
I got out of school and I said, I want to work for this person.
Who was
that? I didn't give a shit what they paid me. There was a guy in Cleveland named Mark Sherry. He was very creative.
Yeah.
Very talented. And then I went from him to a guy named Carl Quagliata. Well,
what do you learn from that guy? Like, what drew you to that guy? Like, what dish?
It wasn't even the dishes. It was the mindset of, you know, Mark taught me that regardless of what you knew, if you didn't buy the best product, you're fucked. like you have to start with something great to end up with something great. Now, you could start with something good and make it very good, but it's hard to start with something crappy and make it great.
Right.
So I learned a lot about purchasing and searching and working with farmers and
building
all that
relationships.
Kind of stuff. Building relationships. I learned a lot of that from Mark. And then when I went and worked for Carl, Carl came from old school Italian restaurateur, but he also had butchers in the family. So he taught me how to break down whole lambs and hogs. And, you know, there was a bandsaw in the restaurant. We would, like, cut all our own meats and steaks.
Yeah.
And he taught me how to use, like, every part of the animal, which is, then you learn how to make money, and then you learn how to control things, and then it creates another creative valve in your head.
Isn't
of
that
like,
French
how do
thinking
I use
too?
All the, yeah, I think French and Italian. You know?
So what do you do with all those bones?
Stock.
Okay. And what do you do with the tongue?
You braise it and shave it onto a sandwich. Or smoke it, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
You throw out the eyes, though.
Yeah, I mean, my uncles would eat them, but that's a whole different story.
It's like there's always that guy. It's like, that's the best part.
Yeah, but like, I mean, like at Mabel's, where you probably went in Cleveland across from Hilarity's, it's like, you know, we did crispy pig ears. We did, you know, the skin, the chicharrones. We did the cheeks. We did, you know, and all that was learned. Variations of that were learned for when I worked for Carl. It was like, he is like, you want to make money in the restaurant business and still serve great food? This is how you do it. You have to learn how to butcher and how to use everything.
You know that guy up in Canada? That Pied de Cochon?
Oh, Pied de Cochon, yeah.
That guy, like, you know, when I first ate there, because I go to Montreal, I used to go to the festival once a year, and I'd go to that place and it was like, what the fuck am I eating?
Yeah, a lot of foie gras and duck in a can.
It's crazy, the foie gras, yeah. Man. And but also he does the whole pig's head.
Yep.
And your guy, Jonathan, used to do a whole pig's head.
Yep.
Because I used to, you know, I'd go eat at the Greenhouse Tavern.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But he started with you.
He did. Yeah, Johnny worked for me for a good amount of time.
And that was like all meat.
Yeah.
And then the last time I went there, it was like, I literally, dude, I was so excited. I was working at, it was a theater. I used to do... You know Nick from Hilarity?
Very well.
Yeah, yeah.
Where he's Greek. I mean, like, you know.
Right, great guy.
We're and, people.
You know, he makes a good steak over there.
Yeah.
But, you know, I went in there because I'd always go to either Lola or to Jonathan's place, but, like, something was off. You know, the food was off, and, like, he didn't seem right, and it was, like, literally days before he closed it down. But I guess that's the
He's racket. In Chicago now. He's doing good. He's a great kid. I mean, he worked for me from when he was a kid, and then I watched him grow, and then we actually helped him find the greenhouse. The greenhouse location... We had the location. We were going to do something there.
It's like 2 hours down.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And then I said, Johnny, you know, like, I'm not ready to open another place. We have first rights to this place. Put your restaurant here.
So you learn how to butcher. You learn how to purchase and order and build and network and understand that, you know, freshness and quality goods. But, like, how do you learn? Is this something you learned in school? Like, it seems to me like I didn't know about all these. I kind of knew about these stations, like you say pantry.
Right.
Or you say, you know, like a baker. But you have to have all this within the restaurant, right?
Correct. I mean, well, depends on the level of restaurant you are. Like, I mean, Lola was an extreme. Like, basically with Lola, we made a decision. We had other restaurants too, so that helped. But we made a decision that Mabel's or Lola was basically going to be a break-even restaurant, and it was there for us to hang our hat,
yeah,
and to teach the next generation of young cooks how to cook. So we had a full butcher department, we had a full pastry department. We had three to four people that worked in our pastry department at all times, sometimes up to five. In Cleveland, most people bought their pastries.
Right.
You know, we had a butcher department. We made all of our own salamis, prosciuttos, cured meats, butchered our own steaks, like all that kind of stuff.
So you got to have like an aging plate?
Yeah. Yeah, we had it right in the restaurant. And yeah. I mean, most restaurants just buy salami, buy cut steaks.
But they can buy good.
You could get good things that way. But right. I felt like.
Got to do it all.
Like, look, we've been very fortunate. We have helped change how people feel about dining in Cleveland. All these great young cooks, people like Johnny and several others, have come through our kitchens. It's our job to continue the education process that I was able to get through school and several restaurants through our restaurant. So if we could teach people how to butcher, how to make salami, how to cure meats, how to make pastries, how to work, you know, I mean, mine and Liz's business partner used to say something like, he'd walk into the restaurant, he was the numbers guy.
Yeah.
He'd be like, it'd be like 5:30, we're just open. He's like, just so you know, there's 30 people in the restaurant and 37 cooks. whatever. Yeah. You know, I'm like, eventually there's going to be 130 people in the restaurant. He goes, there's still 37 cooks. Why do we have 37 cooks?
Yeah.
You know, but it wasn't like for Lola to make money, I would have had to charge double what we charged. And people don't 100% understand that, but that's what it was.
And it's also like, you also knew going in that, I mean, it lasted a long time, man. I mean, you know, restaurants come and go so quickly.
We closed during the pandemic in our 26th year.
Yeah. I think I had probably the same thing twice I ate there, those scallops. I think I had.
Oh,
some.
Yeah.
Because that's a tricky thing, scallops.
Oh, 100%.
100%. Now, how are you with pastry cooking?
Average at best.
Yeah.
Yeah, but I hired great pastry chefs.
That's the real chemists of the...
They're machines. I had back-to-back insanely, you know, up for James Beard Awards, all those kind of things.
Yeah,
insanely
yeah.
good pastry chefs.
Breads, too?
Yeah, breads, too.
Like, it's just so the whole undertaking of fine dining, like for me with fine dining, I eat too fast and I don't know if, you know, I enjoy it, but there's part of me that it's so precious.
We were a Cleveland restaurant and I'm not precious. So like we straddled the line of like, look, I don't like food where people have tongs and this, and not tongs.
Little tweezers.
And tweezers and all that bullshit. Like, it's just too precious for me.
Yeah.
Like, for me.
I don't even know how to eat it.
Yeah. I understand the thought process behind it. I respect it. I have nothing against the chefs that do it.
Yeah.
But yeah. Like, make it delicious. Like, my whole thing is like, make it delicious. You know, like a perfect example of a Los Angeles chef that, like, everything that comes from her hands is spectacular, but it's not precious, is like Mozza. Like Nancy Silverton just makes beautiful food that's not overworked. It's simple, but it's special.
I was there last night for a party.
Yeah, she's magic.
Yeah. I mean, yeah, it's sometimes like it just with pasta in and of itself, it's like, what? Why is this so different?
Yeah, and there's like three things in here, but it's like the best thing I've ever eaten in my life.
Well, that was the experience I had, you know, at Conant. You know, I don't know where he stands in the...
Oh, Scotty's very talented.
Very good, right?
Very talented.
So I remember I go to Scarpetta, you know, because I was watching the Food Network show, and just that basic spaghetti. The
pomodoro.
Yeah, and I'm like, what the fuck?
Yeah, it's tomato sauce, butter, and basil.
But it was the butter.
Oh, so good.
I didn't know what I couldn't figure out
He puts a lot of butter in.
Yeah, man. So, like, when I interviewed him, I went to the restaurant, and he cooked it for me. I'm like, oh, shit. And then when you do that, when you know it's the butter, which I didn't know, but I imagine most chefs know, or is that a unique thing?
Yeah, no, you know. I mean, but he does a little bit more than others. But it's look, going back, like you're like, I got the Julia Child's book. I was going to start cooking on it, but all that goddamn butter.
Yeah.
But like that pasta that you ate.
It's the butter.
Was all that damn butter.
Right. And that was the magic sauce, man.
Because the butter rounds out the acidity and the sweetness of the tomatoes, and it gives it that tremendous mouthfeel.
Yeah.
And it just makes it insane.
See, there's all that thinking too. The mouthfeel, acidity. Like I got that book, Acid Heat.
Oh,
that,
good book, yeah.
You know, to try to get, but like I just walk into a couple recipes and I make them for months.
Right.
And that's it. I don't learn the thing. I innately know sometimes, you know, like I'm, you
well,
know.
What I always tell people is like, look, this is our, like the new Simon book. Suppers is our ninth book. And, you know, and I've done, God, I don't know. I've been on cooking on TV since 1998.
Yeah.
So a lot of recipes. And I'm always like, look, a recipe is a guide to you as a home cook.
Yeah.
The first time you get the book, follow the recipe. And then use your palate to judge where you want that recipe to go. Learn the technique of the recipe. That's the important part. And then, you know, you make the recipe and you're like, I think this should be more spicy. Add some chilies.
Yeah.
You know, I think this is too acidic. Pull out some lemon. Whatever, you know.
Yeah.
Oh, he used cilantro. I'm going to use basil.
Yeah.
You know, so once you learn the technique, you could use the recipe as a guide. Like if you had that book, the, you know, acid, heat, salt, you could go through that book and a recipe that you were doing for a month. And then you could go, you know what, I think it would be a little, like, I like blah, blah, blah. I'm going to try putting that in.
Sure.
And it might change everything for you.
Yeah. So that's the creativity element.
Yeah.
But when you do Lola, now you had a barbecue restaurant, which you still have, right?
Mabel's, yeah.
How far in were you when you opened that?
Mabel's has been open 7 years. So we were, 18 years into Lola?
Now, the barbecue craze is fairly recent.
Yeah, I mean, we were a bit ahead of it,
but
it's exploded. And I mean, the reason I got into barbecue is Food Network and the Chew. I mean, I'm going back over 20 years.
Yeah.
I met this guy named Mike Mills, who has since passed, and they called him the legend.
Yeah.
And, you know, I always say when you're when your nickname is a legend and you didn't give it to yourself,
yeah,
you're a fucking legend.
Right.
You know, and he, to me, was the...
The barbecue guy.
The master. He was in Cleveland for something, and he comes to Lola, and he's sitting at the bar, and I'm just feeding him, and he's like, you should open a barbecue restaurant. Yeah. And I'm like, why do you say that, Mike? He goes, you make and smoke your own bacon. You smoke pastrami. You're doing all these barbecue things.
Yeah.
And I went out and spent a little bit of time with him, and I just continued to fall in love.
Where was he?
He was in St. Louis and Murfreesboro. So it was like...
That's barbecue land.
Yeah, barbecue. You know, and he was just the best at it. He was a three- or four-time world champ, had won Memphis in May several times. Like, just incredible.
It seems like there's like a lot of creativity possible with barbecue.
And that's what's happening now. Like, it used to be like, okay, you do Texas.
Or you do
Kansas City.
Yeah.
You do, you know. Now it's getting a little bit more hyper-local. Like Mabel's, we do Cleveland barbecue. When I first said that, people were like, well, what the hell does that even mean?
Yeah, I'm
like,
what does it mean?
It's the flavors that I grew up with. So like our sauce is based on, the base of our sauce is Burtman's ballpark mustard, which they serve at all the stadiums and arenas in Cleveland. You know, I don't do raw onions like they do in Texas. I do sauerkraut because it's Cleveland, you know, so we smoke with apple and cherry woods because those, you know, we don't use post oak, but if within 20 miles of Cleveland, there's apple and cherry orchards everywhere.
Right.
You know, and peach.
And you find that it stands out because of those things? Like, you can identify that?
Yeah, I can. And I mean, I don't know, like, of course I think it stands out, but it makes it uniquely ours. And
so what is Cleveland? Like, is that German-based, Polish-based?
Very, very Eastern European, German, Polish, Irish.
Right.
But like, I would never, like, why would I open up a Texas barbecue restaurant in Cleveland? It doesn't even make any damn sense.
Well, that's smart, you know, because I got into this thing with barbecue. I'm only going to eat it where it comes from.
Right.
So I go to Texas, and I go out to this place called Opie's because it's a drive, and it looks like it's supposed to.
Yeah, it's processed, right.
And they treat me well. Because I think when you get to a certain level with brisket, you know, if it's good brisket, it's going to be good.
Right.
Right? But I wouldn't eat it anywhere else because there just seemed like so many people were just popping up with
that. Yeah, and why should I make a brisket like they make in Texas? Because the Texas brisket screams of Texas, you know? So, like, you know, we do more...
What
like
do you do with your brisket?
Well, our brisket, we season it with more the spices you might find in a pastrami.
Okay.
You know, and we smoke it with fruit woods. A lot of pepper, coriander, you know, like those kind of things.
Uh-huh.
So, like, it still tastes like a great smoked brisket, but it has... A flavor profile that sings more to Cleveland.
Yeah.
You know.
And what was the third restaurant that you had?
We had a place called Lolita.
Yeah.
But it burnt down.
It burnt down?
Yeah. It was all wood fired, and it we had a fire there. I mean, it's been a while now. It's been like 7-8 years ago now.
So now, when does this Top Chef business start?
Well, Iron Chef was before any of them. It was before Top Chef. It was before Hell's Kitchen.
That was the Asian one, right?
Yeah, it started in Japan, and then it came to America in, 2003, maybe?
But what was your break on the Food Network? What were you doing?
Well, my first show on the Food Network was a show called The Melting Pot in 1998.
What was the angle?
It was Eastern European food.
Okay.
Because it was from my, you know, Cleveland roots. And
pierogies?
Pierogies and, you know, all that kind of Eastern Euro food.
Yeah.
And I had a co-host named Wayne Harley Brackman.
Yeah.
Who was Bobby's pastry chef.
Bobby Flay's?
Yep.
Yeah.
And then I did that for 2 years. And, you know, this was before Rachel Ray. And, like, there weren't a lot of viewers of the Food Network back then. And, I mean, I remember saying to Bobby, this just isn't, like, we don't get paid anything. At the time, the original Lola was me and two other cooks. So for me to leave and film for 2 weeks was very difficult.
Yeah.
You know, I stopped doing Food Network. I would still do specials with them.
Yeah.
And then when Iron Chef started, they asked me to do Next Iron Chef, which I won. And then I became an Iron Chef and did that for a long time. And,
yeah.
And then that led to several other shows on the Food Network, which led to The Chew, the ABC show. So,
yeah.
You know, we had a talk show on ABC for, 7 years. We did... 2,000 episodes of television.
Because I remember when it happened, you know, the Food Network, because I was sort of a Chopped addict, You know, because like I like the idea of bringing all that garbage together and making something. And then you really got to see the chef's personalities in a different way. But were you aware? I mean, when did you become aware that that thousands of people were locking into this?
Well,
thing?
Iron Chef. You know, so like,
but that was a competition show. They're all competition shows.
Yeah, but there weren't any back then.
Yeah,
that was the first one. So it like, so you know, prior to Iron Chef. You know, I won Food and Wine Best New Chef. I won James Beard Award. I won all that shit.
You get the Michelin stars?
Cleveland didn't have Michelin, doesn't have Michelin stars.
So why?
They just don't have it.
What does that mean they don't have
Michelin
it?
Michelin stars only in Los Angeles, New York, Chicago, and San Francisco.
Really?
Yeah.
It's not like a countrywide thing because it's so specific.
Right.
So if you want to go get that star,
you got to be in one of those cities.
Huh. Did you rally for that? Couldn't you get a board?
I tried
together?
And they basically were like,
we're not going to Cleveland.
We're not going.
You're the only guy there. What are we going to do in Cleveland? So, it was a setup.
It for was, you. Yeah. So when I won Next Iron Chef, the amount of media coverage for that show was like nothing I had ever seen before. Like it was insane.
Yeah.
They named a street after me in Cleveland after I won Iron Chef.
Yeah.
Which is bananas. I mean, come on. You know
what's on that street,
Lola.
So it's that one street.
Yeah. So it that's when I realized, even though I had been on Food Network for a long time, that's when I realized the power of it.
Yeah,
you know, I really truly realized the power of it.
Yeah, and because of that, you know, because there was only a handful of you guys and women, then the restaurants filled up, right?
Oh yeah, I mean there were when I first became an Iron Chef, there were only four of us, you know, and
who was it
to about seven after that? It was myself, Bobby Morimoto, and Kat Cora.
Uh-huh. Now Bobby, you guys get along
very well. He's one of my dearest friends.
Yeah
We're so different, it's unbelievable, which is probably why,
because
we get along,
it's
so
you
well.
Too, you guys got the top chefs more than anybody, right?
Yeah, him and I have done more, I think, more Iron Chef battles than anyone.
And like with him, I noticed, because like, you know look, I eat more basic than I'd like to admit, but you know, with him it was like there was 900 sauces.
A lot of stuff going on. But his food's gotten simpler now. I kid with them now. I'm like, why do you want to be Italian now? You used to make fun of me all the time, but now you want to be Italian?
But he wanted to be Mexican for a long time.
Yeah, but he loves the. He's just a great chef, and Bobby's a great guy.
What is it
Bobby,
though? Like, you know, you guys have styles. So, you know, what's your difference in styles in terms?
I would say he's more Southwestern influenced, more chili influenced. Yeah. The funny thing is, it's like, I think if people thought of us as chefs, they'd think we were very different.
Yeah.
But we cook together all the time.
Yeah.
Like, on TV and at home. And we cook very similar.
Yeah.
It's just how people think of our food is different.
Sure.
But the way we go about it is very, very similar.
Well, I notice that sometimes when I see these, when guys at your level are cooking and you can see it, is that there's a shorthand to it. Like, you know, even if you know what they're doing, but there'll be an ingredient or something like, oh, okay.
Right. Well, so. Yeah. Like, I mean, like, you know, like we would, like Bobby and I, like if we were making a dish, we'd probably get to a certain point.
Yeah.
And then it'd be like, I'd be like, okay, I'm going to finish this with mint, flaxseed, parsley, and dill, and he's like, I'm going to finish it with, you know, chipotle, ancho chilies, and something.
Right.
Like, everything up to that point is the same.
Right. But where did you draw the line in terms of when, you know, the art of fine dining sort of started to, you know, there were a lot of fusions going on that seemed like a stretch, and then there was the period of the foams and the...
I hate that shit.
But that's what I got the sense of, like, almost always, like, the old school guys are like, what is that?
Just pisses me off.
Like, with smoking
things.
I
remember
things.
Someone said, like, try this tomato foam. It tastes just like a tomato. I'm like, just give me a fucking tomato. Like, I don't understand.
So that was sort of a fad.
Yeah, I mean, but it's still around. And I mean, I guess it has a value like anything else.
Looks weird.
Yeah, I mean, I don't, it's just not my thing. I try not to poo-poo things that aren't my thing, because then you just sound like, oh, you know, you don't doesn't understand it. I understand it just fine. I could do it just fine. I just don't like it. Like,
but it's interesting. So most of the stuff, like Eastern European, you know, Greek, Italian, and French, that all sort of makes sense. You can kind of move through those, right?
Yeah, you can
move
through it. And I mean, but the way that I cook too, it's like, look, almost everything that we've cooked in our restaurants and I do is over live fire. I've always cooked over live fire.
Yeah.
You know, to me, that is... a skill and creates a unique flavor that no one else has. And, you know, like putting things in and out of wood burning ovens and wood burning grills.
Yeah.
And smokers now and things of that nature. It like, I would rather spend my time doing that than making a gelée or a foam or a, it's just.
It's more, it seems more kind of honest.
Yeah.
And what about Asian fusion?
I love Asian food. I don't cook it, but I love it.
Now,
when
I try
to cook it, I screw it all up.
Because, like, that seems to be, same with Mexican and Southwestern, is that there's an entirely different spice and style spectrum to, and Asian's been around for thousands of years.
Yeah, I mean,
so you're dealing with some deep shit.
Oh, really great stuff. It's just, you know, I've never been trained in it. So
yeah.
I sometimes I'll pull something here and there, and, but for the most part, my food stays in, like, you know, live fire, meat centric.
Yeah.
And then like a lot of crunchy vegetables.
Right.
Like that's how I cook. Like that, if I had to like sum it, like acidity, fire, meat, raw veg.
Yeah, because there's interesting people, like, you know Bayless?
Yeah, I know him very well.
Like, he did, like,
he lived in Cleveland for a long time.
Did he?
Yeah.
Now, he seems like an interesting guy, because, like, there was a point there where I would go to that Chicago airport, and he had that
sandwich place, yeah.
And I was Torta, right?
Yeah.
And I was like, I'd look forward to going.
It was a good sandwich, man.
Right?
Torta was I don't know if it's still there, but, man, delicious.
I got to fly American,
yeah,
because
right,
of that fucking restaurant.
That's where that thing is. It's right in the terminal.
Yeah. It's interesting to me that something so simple can make such a difference. Like, there is really kind of some outstanding thing.
But Rick, you know, Rick is a student of that cuisine. And, I mean, really understands it and puts his little twists on it.
Yeah.
It's incredibly delicious.
So what are you doing, like, outside of, like, this new Simply Simon Suppers, which, like, when you approach putting a cookbook together, like you said, the last two were kind of a little more health-oriented. But, like, when you're going to do a new cookbook, like, you, what was the angle on this? How'd you break it down?
This one is, like, I grew up, again, the Greek-Sicilian family.
Yeah.
People were at our house every Sunday. We did Sunday supper every week.
Yeah.
But it was always the same
with the gravy.
It was the same exact Sunday supper: cavatelle. My mom called it Sunday sauce, but gravy.
Yeah,
garlic bread, big salad. Like, it was always the same.
Yeah,
and there were always anywhere from 8 to 20 people, and that was that.
Yeah,
and so what Liz and I have been doing now for God as long
your
as
wife?
I can remember. Liz is my wife and partner in all the restaurants and Assam and designs the restaurants. Incredible. Palette. She does the Food Network show Simon's Dinners with me in our backyard. So every Sunday, if we're not traveling or working or whatever, we do Sunday supper.
Yeah.
And all of our friends come over, family comes over, and I do a different one every week. And so this book is 52 weeks of Sunday suppers, basically.
And when you prepare something like that, you sit down, you just write it down, you lay it out, you decide.
No, I just cook. You
right.
know, and then I write the notes of what I made.
Yeah.
And then we recreate it into the book. And the book is fun because, you know, typically a cookbook is broken down into like starters, salads, entrees, desserts, whatever. So we did this a little bit more throughout the seasons.
But
we also broke it just down per meal. So like every recipe is a full meal.
Yeah.
So there's closer to 185 recipes in the book. But they're broken down for meals, including holidays.
Oh,
so it's like 52 weeks of meals.
Right. Oh, that's great. And now, all right, so let's just say, like, where do you eat in L.A.?
I'm currently in love. There's a restaurant now. Again, I'm in Venice. So we love a restaurant called, Liz and I love a restaurant called Hatchet Hall.
Yeah.
In Culver City. Yeah, we're kind of getting our L.A. roots back a little bit.
Uh-huh.
So we're discovering some new places. You know, we're just... It's a great food town. I actually, Liz and I were talking the other day, and all my New York friends are going to punch me in the face when I get back.
Yeah.
But I actually think LA may be the best food city in America right now.
Oh my God, I got to go out more.
Yeah, it's really, because there's a lot of creativity going on. There's a lot of, I mean, obviously the product here is unmatched.
Yeah.
But we've just had, maybe it's because we're going to places that we haven't been.
Yeah.
So there's some of that, but I think LA may be the best food city in America right now.
Huh. And where do you stand on fish?
I love to eat fish.
It's hard. It's hard to make it interesting, isn't it?
No, I don't think so. I mean, I guess it depends on the
sure.
the fish. But
yeah.
I find fish to be very versatile, incredible, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
It's very different than cooking meats. It takes a little bit more finesse and, you know, I feel there's a gentleness that comes with fish.
Sure, yeah, yeah, yeah. You don't want to overcook it.
Right.
Yeah. All right, man. So the only restaurant you got going still is Mabel's?
Just Mabel's. Well, we also have Angeline at the Borgata in Atlantic City, which is an Italian restaurant named after my mom.
Yeah.
Which I love.
Yeah.
It's you know, Italian-American restaurant.
Sure.
And then we have some really casual Bar Simons, which are in like some airports and stuff. But like our freestanding restaurants are Angeline and Mabel's. And we may, you know, I'm going to say it here because sometimes when I say things, they happen. And I've been trying to convince my wife, Liz, of this. I really, really want to open a little Greek restaurant in L.A.
Please, man. Greek is the best. I used to live in Astoria. It's the best.
Oh, it's the best.
It's so clean and it's so simple.
Yep. There's such a beauty about Greek food. And it's so celebratory.
Yeah.
You know, so that's, I'm trying to... Try to convince Liz of it. We'll see what happens.
I used to go to Kiklides.
Oh yeah.
It's the best.
The great.
That fucking octopus dude.
Oh, so good.
It's so simple.
Good. Yeah.
Great talking to you, Michael.
So fun. Thank you.
Yep. There you go. That was nice. I'm definitely gonna go down there and talk to Michael Moore. Nice guy. Simply Simon Suppers, recipes and menus for every week of the year comes out next week, Tuesday. September 12th. Again, you can pre-order it right now and hang out for a minute, will you, folks? Hey, folks, this episode is brought to you by Kleenex Ultra Soft Tissues, your ally to help tackle your allergy symptoms this season. I love the change of seasons, but nobody loves pollen and all those other things floating in the air that make you sneeze during this nice weather. Kleenex Ultra Soft Tissues are hypoallergenic and allergist approved. So fight back against watery eyes and runny noses without worrying about irritating your skin. You know all those times you've heard guests sneeze on the show? Well, actually, you don't hear any of that because we cut the sneezes out when we're editing. But take my word for it, people definitely sneeze in here, and when they do, I've got a box of Kleenex on the table right in front of them so they can use one and get right back to business. And here's what Kleenex means to me. A tissue that will hold up. We've all used those other tissues that you blow holes right through. When I see Kleenex, I know that tissue is up for the job. For this allergy season, grab Kleenex and face allergies head on. People, if you're signed up for the Full Marin, tomorrow we'll have even more of my talk with Todd posted exclusively for Full Marin subscribers. It's just very odd when you're in a fairly small gathering and, you know, Lorne Michaels walks in.
Right. You're like, oh, am I auditioning now?
Well, that's why I said I texted the group text the day after. I said, I think I got SNL.
That's funny.
Thanks, everyone. Did you ever audition for that?
Yeah, I did.
Yeah?
I don't know why I'm hesitating. I did two rounds of stand-up, and the second round was... I did the first in front of, like, Marcy Klein, I think.
Right.
And then the second round was at the comic strip with him there.
Right. I think I was on that same thing.
And it went fine, but it was also a thing, like, I never thought I would be an SNL guy, so yeah. I think I just fell into the audition, and...
That must have been around the time when I auditioned.
Yeah.
It must have been that same bunch of auditions, right?
Probably, what, yeah.
We were like 12 years old?
Yeah, I think I was 9.
Yeah, were we like 20-something?
Yeah.
To sign up for the Full Marin, go to the link in the episode description or go to WTFpod.com and click on WTF Plus. This guitar take, I had the slide guitar. I had the open G-tuned guitar plugged in, so I just picked it up. And this is sort of a first take. I rarely do that. But I was recording and I didn't really realize it. So this, I just picked it up and did this and I thought it made sense. So here you go. The end part, the Boomer Lives part got a little, I had some level control issues. We'll be right back. Kramer lives.